This week on Capitalism, Race, and Democracy.
I think Petro really shined. I think he proved a lot of people wrong who didn't think the meeting was going to go well, who hoped the meeting would not go well. And he returned a conquering hero. He did a great job, and he made peace where war could have happened. So I'm very honored to serve him, very proud to know him.
Attorney Dan Kovalik was part of a team who accompanied Colombian President Gustavo Petro to the White House to meet with Donald Trump on February 3rd.
Look at San Francisco. Look how unified we were to fight against this. I'm sure in L.A., San Diego, they're going to succeed too.
Thousands of San Francisco teachers struck and won a tentative deal for fully paid health care.
This is about establishing new economic indexes for new financial instruments through which natural and human resources can be monetized and exploited under the guise of social justice and environmental conservation.
As AI accelerates the privatization of public education, Professor John Klyzek warns that schools are becoming the front line of a technocratic global agenda.
They're literally creating viruses, like they're creating new pathogens to use for vaccines, and these can all leak out of their labs. They're not very contained very well, and we have to remember most of these labs are in population centers.
Epidemiologist Nicholas Hulscher warns about the implications of unregulated for-profit biolabs scattered around the U.S. and the world. From Pacifica Radio, this is Capitalism, Race, and Democracy, a collective effort by producers from Pacifica stations and affiliates across the U.S. I'm your host, Ann Garrison. Colombian President Gustavo Petro traveled to Washington to meet with President Trump on February 3rd to try to avert a war in the Caribbean. I spoke to American attorney Dan Kovalik, who was part of a team who helped President Petro prepare for the meeting, then traveled to the White House with him.
Dan Kovalik, on February 3rd, President Gustavo Petro went to meet with President Donald Trump at the White House. At the time, Donald Trump had the most powerful Navy and Air Force in the world in the Caribbean, basically threatening Colombia if it didn't get what it wanted. So what did it want, and how did this play out?
Yes, well, obviously it wanted Venezuela's oil. I mean, that was a big thing. But in terms of Colombia, what did it want from Colombia? At least what the U.S. claimed it wanted was closer cooperation with Colombia on drug eradication, on fighting drug trafficking, also some help getting energy to Venezuela to get its oil industry back online. And those were the main asks of the president.
Well, do you think the president is really serious, that President Trump is really serious about interdicting drug traffic?
Well, I think that it's not a major concern of his, and I think it's mixed. I mean, in the sense that, yes, I think he wants a win in terms of being able to show he stopped the drug trafficking from South America. In fact, I just saw that the U.S. and Colombia interdicted 10 They seized 10 tons of cocaine in a joint operation in the last couple of days. So I think there is some interest there. I think more to the point, I think Trump also realized Colombia is a necessary ally in the region and that it couldn't afford to continue to threaten Colombia, to alienate Colombia. I think that might have been a bigger issue.
And so what did President Petro demand or ask for? I don't know which is the more appropriate term.
Well, President Petro, I mean, he didn't, you know, have major demands of Trump. I mean, he basically said, look, if you want more drug eradication and you want to go after the cartels, then we need U.S. cooperation to do that. We need U.S. help. Mm-hmm. Also, he pointed out, he said, well, you know, we're happy to go after the drug cartel leaders in Colombia, but he said those are the small guys. He said, the big guys are in Miami and Dubai and Madrid, right? And he said, are you going to go after those guys?
Mm-hmm.
You know, which is interesting.
That's the first time I've heard Madrid.
Yeah, I don't know if it was Madrid. It was some city in Spain. But, you know, anyway.
Uh-huh. Okay.
And then, but also he talked about wanting to eradicate drugs through drug substitution. And Colombia has a program for that, that Petro is spearheaded, and that is encouraging farmers who grow coca to grow other things like chocolate, coffee. And that's been very successful. And he mentioned that to Trump and said that, again, U.S. companies could help with that. And also U.S. development agencies could help with that, which Trump seemed interested in. In fact, they gave him and Rubio a present, coffee and chocolate from some farmers who were part of this substitution program who used to grow coca, which was converted into cocaine, and now grow these other items.
Huh. Interesting. It's hard to believe that Trump really cares about drug eradication, given that he just pardoned, I think it's Juan Hernandez, said his name, the drug kingpin who was in charge of Honduras for so long.
Right. And there's, you know, the Salvadoran government is now deeply involved in the drug trade, and no one seems to care about that. So, I mean, I hear what you're saying. I think there's a lot of double standards there. But I do think, for whatever reason, he has some interest in stopping the drugs coming out of Colombia. Again, at least for PR purposes.
Yeah, PR purposes. Yeah, I would, at least. Well, is there anything else that Trump demanded?
No, those were the main things, going after high-value targets, HVTs, you know, heads of cartels in Colombia, drug eradication, and also Ecopetrol. The head of Ecopetrol was there, which is the national oil company of Colombia, and they offered to help get energy to build pipelines to get energy to Venezuela, to help Venezuela get back on its feet, get its oil industry back on its feet. I mean, those were the three main things.
How would pipelines from Colombia to Venezuela help Venezuela?
Well, they need fuel. They need fuel. It sounds strange, but until they get the oil industry back online, they need fuel. So that would bring fuel from Colombia into Venezuela. I think they talked specifically about natural gas, as I recall.
Mm-hmm. Okay, and did they discuss President Maduro, who is now sitting in prison? In New York
they
City.
Were not. They did not discuss Maduro. In fact, Trump asked, he had a compound question asking about Brazil and Trump's actions in Venezuela, and Petro was careful not to go down that road on Venezuela because he knew it would not help the meeting to do that. But Petro's been very open that Maduro should not have been kidnapped, and that he, if the Venezuelans think he's done something wrong, they should try him themselves. He shouldn't be tried in the United States.
Were there any issues about Colombia's social programs?
No, they weren't asked about those. They weren't asked about China. They weren't asked about Cuba. They weren't asked about Gaza. So a lot of more contentious issues just weren't dealt with.
Even though President Petro was kicked out of the country after he addressed a pro-Palestinian rally at the UN's annual gathering, they didn't talk about that.
No, it was not discussed. And, you know, we thought it might be, but it wasn't. It wasn't brought up.
Hmm.
I mean, honestly, I felt that Trump came to the meeting wanting for the meeting to go well, and Petro came to the meeting wanting for the meeting to go well. And as a consequence, it went well.
Huh. No one came in with a confrontational attitude.
Well, not Trump or Petro. I think I think Vance and Rubio had more of a contentious attitude, but, you know, they were pretty much shut down by Trump.
Were they there?
Yes.
They were. Okay. Were you present?
No, I was not.
You were. Okay. Now, what makes you say that this is the best thing you ever did?
Well, because I did help prepare President Petro for the meeting, and I feel that I helped in a some modest way anyway. And so I feel some gratification there. But also, I spent a week, you know, with President Petro, and that was great. I mean, it was a great honor for me. It was, you know, and it was a success, and it was a team effort. Many of us helped out with that, and I was part of that team, and so that feels great.
What about the sanctions? Did you discuss the sanctions?
No, those weren't discussed. Sanctions on Venezuela were discussed, and Trump himself showed some willingness to lift those. The OFAC issue was not raised, and we all agreed on our side it shouldn't be raised. That was not the place to raise it.
Okay, well, is there anything else you'd like to say?
Just that I think Petro, you know, really shined. I think he proved a lot of people wrong who didn't think the meeting was going to go well, who hoped the meeting would not go well, and he returned a conquering hero. He did a great job, and he made peace where war could have happened. So I'm, you know, very honored to serve him, very proud to know him.
That was my conversation with Attorney Dan Kovalik, who represents Colombian President Gustavo Petro with regard to U.S. sanctions. He also worked with the team helping President Petro prepare for his February 3rd meeting with President Trump. Was Berriado Carbono y su conjunto Palenque. This is Pacifica's Capitalism, Race, and Democracy. I'm Ann Garrison. Thousands of San Francisco teachers went on strike this past week and reached a tentative agreement that includes fully paid health care starting next year. Over 70 billionaires live in San Francisco, and yet salaried teachers have minimal health care coverage. Teachers spoke out about their fight and the connection between education and the massive U.S. spending for genocide in Gaza and the $1 trillion military budget. Teachers rallied at San Francisco Mission High School and called out Superintendent Maria Sue.
I'm out here for my students, my little students who I work with, and to make sure that they get the education that they need and deserve. We all deserve an education. It doesn't matter who you are, where you come from, you deserve a fair education. And this woman here, she doesn't care, and she does not want to give in. And we will not give in, because our children mean just that much to us.
And there's so many billionaires in San Francisco.
Oh, my God. Billionaires, if you are really concerned about the schools being closed, give us the money. Use your billions to do something good with it. It's just that simple.
How long have you been teaching? Been in the schools?
30 years. 30 years with little muffins that I love to death.
And the idea that teachers and their families can't afford health care, what is that all about?
Well, they believe that we should be able-bodied people working for the school district. We are not allowed to get sick. We are not allowed to have health care. So why put money in the health care system if you don't want it to be there? Just as simple.
Are you surprised by the solidarity here?
Not surprised. I'm surprised that she feels like it's okay to keep saying no to what we need. Not what we are wanting, but what we need.
What's your name?
LaWanda.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Can you introduce yourself?
Yeah, yeah. Hi, my name is Sam Konzadeh. I'm an English teacher right here at Mission High School.
So there's been a tremendous show of solidarity with the community, the marches. I mean, it's historic, the kind of marches that you've had and rallies. What do you think has been the outcome of it, and what do you think is going to happen now in the future?
Wow. I mean, the sign of solidarity all across the city, you know, from all groups, from children to parents to families to people that don't even have children in the district, just all across the city, immense unity. It shows us that we are all on the right side. We are all on the right side of history. We all understand that what we want are basic rights. Healthcare is a human right. What we're fighting for isn't outrageous. It's something that should be given to all of us. And so I think this is just the beginning. I think from here forward, we should be fighting more and more to make sure we get what we need as educators, as members of our community, so our youth can succeed and get what they need.
And one of the issues is the turnover of the staff, a lot of staff leaving. Why don't you talk about how that's affected your school here in Mission and what that means to the future of public education in San Francisco?
Yeah, let me tell you, I'm in the English department. 1 year, 2 years ago, we were short four teachers, four English teachers. That means there were four different groups of students that were lacking an English teacher. They had substitutes coming and going, and that, of course, affects the education of our students. When we have these, you know, healthcare, higher wages, we're going to have less turnover. We're going to have more higher retention and more incentive for teachers to come teach at this beautiful school in this beautiful city.
And the situation in California, there are other schools, there may be another 80,000 teachers going out on strike. It seems like it's not just an issue for San Francisco, but throughout the state. What's going to happen? Because there are over 200 billionaires in California, yet they don't seem to have funding for public education.
Hey, listen, we don't need the billionaires. The billionaires need us. I think looking at San Francisco, they can see that we've outnumbered them 10 to a million, right? So they need to understand that we, the people, need the power. We need the support. We need the resources. And so we don't have room for all these billionaires in California. And so look at San Francisco. Look how unified we were to fight against this. I'm sure in LA, San Diego, they're going to succeed too.
And the kind of solidarity you had, it seems like right now, all over, the people were excited.
Yeah.
I want to support you.
Yeah.
What does that mean to you and to the teachers?
You know, it means that people understand that it is in schools, it's inside the schools that community really just blossoms and blooms, right? It is in education where you see the youth grow up, mature, and take control of the world. So, I mean, the city sees that, we see it in the city. People want to support schools because this is what it's all about.
And one of the issues, of course, is ICE, the raids that have happened, what happened in Minneapolis.
Yeah.
The ICE goons, basically, Gestapo, shooting people in cold blood. I mean, for a teacher, for schools, I mean, it seems like this is a real existential crisis. What it's doing to students, the trauma of students here. Can you talk about that?
Yeah. People, students cannot learn if they don't feel safe. This is a sanctuary city. This should be a sanctuary school. This is a place where students, first and foremost, feel safe. If they feel safe, then they can learn. Right? So ICE, all they're doing, all Trump's regime is doing is spreading fear. This is where we fight fear. This is where we tell the kids, hey, you're safe over here. Here, you can share your thoughts. You can learn.
And what do you think the response of the union should be if, say, they try to do a surge here in San Francisco in the Bay Area?
We won't let them in. We'll fight back tooth and nail.
Is the union prepared to do that?
Absolutely.
How is it prepared?
I mean, we have our entire building is fighting back completely to say no ICE let into our schools, ensuring our students get to school safely. We're doing everything we can to make sure our students feel safe leaving the house to get into school and going back home.
And it seems like this country has trillions of dollars for war.
Yeah.
Yet healthcare is a national problem. People are losing their Medicaid. The money that they're talking about for these detention centers, $70 billion from ICE, seems like it's unlimited. Are the priorities, what's wrong with the priorities?
I think it's pretty simple. When you have a regime that prioritizes war and prioritizes oppression, they're trying to keep power over the people by cutting funding from schools, by cutting funding from making places into a safe place. It's all by design. They want to keep people down so they can maintain control over us.
And so what can people learn from your struggle here in San Francisco?
That, hey, we are the majority. We got this. All we got to do is unify together and show them that, hey, you can't get us. Look at Minneapolis. They fought back. ICE is leaving, right? The people have the power.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, man.
Good.
Thank you.
Hi, I'm Nadia Mufti. I'm a teacher here at Mission High, and today we're celebrating our win.
And there was tremendous solidarity, mass marches. Were you surprised about the kind of solidarity there was for this strike?
I wasn't surprised because Mission is full of working folks that want to be in community, and it was beautiful to see solidarity everywhere we went, on the bus, on the street, here at Mission. People really wanted us to win.
And the issue of Palestine came up during the strike. What does this mean to Palestine? What's the connection between the struggle here in Palestine?
To me, good education, quality education is violence prevention. And we see racism, sexism, classism, ableism on a state, local, federal level, globally. We're seeing that from here to Palestine, Minnesota, Venezuela. We're seeing that it's everywhere. So to me, when we fight for good quality education for our students, we are preventing future violence.
The money that's going for war, for genocide, trillions of dollars. I mean, where's the priority?
Right. We always have money for ICE, for police, for the military, for occupation, for genocide, but we never have enough money for schools. If you really want us to believe that you care about our youth, then you need to invest in Black communities, you need to invest in our migrant communities, you need to invest in public transportation, you need to invest in schools, invest in our youth, invest in our future.
And the people of Minneapolis were angry. And the government, Trump thought they could crush them, but they seem to have organized in the community, in the schools, to defend themselves. What's the lesson of that for working people here and around the country? What's the lesson of that struggle in Minneapolis?
I think the lesson of the struggle in Minneapolis is that when people come together, we are more powerful than the ruling class. We saw that here with the walkouts with students here in Mission High School all across the city. They came here to Dolores Park.
When did that happen?
That was 2 weeks ago. 100,000 people came out here to Dolores Park in support of the student-led walkouts. So youth power is powerful. We can't ignore or suppress our youth.
And the young people, they seem to feel that this was their strike. It wasn't just the teachers.
Absolutely. This is a strike for their education, for their future. So of course they came out to support, and we're so glad that they did.
And there are supposedly 80,000 more teachers in California that may be going on strike. It seems like there's a wave now taking place in this country of unions, working people, Kaiser workers that are fed up with what's going on.
Absolutely. I mean, the fight is not over. Just because we won this strike doesn't mean that the fight is over. The struggle for liberation continues globally.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you so much.
Good.
Those were the voices of San Francisco teachers, all members of United Educators of San Francisco. Another 80,000 California teachers are now engaged in contract fights.
If you ask me what the time is, as they raid the city, as they're rounding up our neighbor's hog, tying the community, I'd say it's time to execute a particular solution known by lots of different names. I'd call it liberation when we tear down all the borders, round up all the billionaires, give away everything that used to be theirs. If you ask me what the time is, while the town is all on fire, as the algorithms tell the landlords to go higher according to each profile determining the rent. But what'll happen to feudalism, landlords and tenants? just withering away, crying in the rainstorm that washed away their mattress. There isn't any way civilization looks like this. So how about we tear down all the borders, round up all the billionaires, give away everything that used to be theirs.
That was Round Up All the Billionaires, written by David Robix, performed by A.I. Tsuyo. You're listening to Pacifica's Capitalism, Race, and Democracy. I'm your host, Ann Garrison. The use of AI to commodify all public resources is most developed in public education, which for decades has been a testing ground for the technocracy. Professor John Klysak's book, School World Order, The Technocratic Globalization of Corporatized Education, is about this agenda. He spoke about it last week in Wilmington, California, at a conference called AI, Labor, and the Future of LA and the World.
Very top one. The very top one is, it starts off with an investor that's going to put some money up front. The intermediary is going to be the impact investment company. Okay, and so in the example I'll illustrate here, the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation gives money to an impact investment firm, an intermediary known as Social Finance. Social Finance then funds Upswing, which is the social service provider. Then Upswing services the needed populations, so in this case, students, and the needs that it's going to service are either going to be, right, educational learning outcomes or mental health care wellness outcomes. And this is where Anna comes in. This is where the AI comes in, because the AI is what's going to be doing the data mining so that they can produce the metrics to show that they have achieved those impacts or outcomes in order to reimburse that money from the government. So after they get those, collect that data, it then goes to independent validators, and they're going to use indexes that fall under basically social credit metrics. Okay, and these could be anything from ESG to SDG to DEI. And after they produce those outcomes and get them authenticated by the independent reviewers, they send that to the government, and then the government pays back the monies, right? Potentially all of it, or maybe a profit. A little bit about the indexes for a second here, before we look at some of the actual venture capital firms and impact investment firms that are funding Upswing currently. So largely these are standardized by global governance institutions, including the World Economic Forum and the United Nations. And so we've got three broad sets of indexes, ESG, SDG, and DEI. These are basically recursively interchangeable for the most part. Okay, so like in ESG, it's environmental, social, and government scoring. It's basically corporate social credit scoring, heavily promoted by the World Economic Forum and the UN. The environmental part largely overlaps with the core of the SDGs. So the SDGs are the Sustainable Development Goals. We usually think of these as environmental. So like goals number 6, 7, 13, 14, and 15 all relate to biodiversity and natural resource stewardship. But if you look at the S part, the social part, right, that's essentially going to be overlap with the DEI stuff. But if you look at the SDGs, numbers 1, 2, 5, and 10, those all focus on socioeconomic, ethnic, gender equity, et cetera. And then the governance part has to do with public-private stakeholder representation based on stakeholder capitalism econometrics formulated by Klaus Schwab himself. He's the former chair, founder of the World Economic Forum. Now, just to take a little note here before we look at some of those impact investment firms, I want to disabuse you of any notion that any of these environmental, social governance, SDG, DEI scores have anything to do with protecting the environment or helping marginalized groups of people. This is about establishing new economic indexes for new financial instruments through which natural and human resources can be monetized and exploited under the guise of social justice and environmental conservation. Okay. So take a look at some of these. This is a nice overview of some of the larger impact investment firms and others that are financing impact investments at Upswing. So some of these are not actually impact investment firms proper, right? So like Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, Lumina Foundation, JPMorgan Chase, but the investments that they provide for Upswing are effectively impact investments. So like JP Morgan Chase, the monies that they're giving to Upswing is aimed at improving outcomes for HBCUs, historically black colleges and universities. Okay. So if we look at, let's just walk through some of these. So the Lumina Foundation, let's just look at some of like who's behind these companies, how do they overlap and interlock. Lumina Foundation on the board serves Austin Goolsbee. He was, well, he currently is the president of the Federal Reserve Bank of Chicago, and he was formerly the chair of the Council of Economic Advisors under President Barack Obama, and he happens to be a member of the Order Skull and Bones. The Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, we noted, right, funds social finance, but it also directly funds Upswing as well, okay? And then social finance has partnered with the Charles Koch Foundation and Google itself to procure other impact investments for other projects. Google here is, again, it's not an impact investment firm, but the arm of Google that's involved in financing Upswing is it's their Google for Startups Accelerator. So it's basically your venture capital arm of Google. And this one is geared toward helping black-owned businesses, so black entrepreneurs, again, under the guise of helping marginalized groups. If we look at Imaginable Futures, this is set up by Pierre Omidyar. He's the guy that set up eBay, one of the biggest e-commerce giants. And eBay, on record, has had some interesting ties to the Central Intelligence Agency, and it was the CIA. It was their venture capital firm InQtel. It was probably one of the most prominent venture capital firms that we know about. And InQtel was what provided some of the seed monies for Google, particularly to fund the, what was their Maps program before it was called Keyhole or something like that. I can't remember what it was called before it was Google Maps, but InQtel funded that. And InQtel also funded Palantir, has funded Palantir, which is founded by Peter Thiel, and Peter Thiel coming out of Stanford business, Stanford, where they have their own impact investment firm that also funds Upswing, okay? So the main takeaway, that I want you all to take from this is that this AI thing is not just about automating labor in order to consolidate the means of production. It's about scaling ubiquitous biopsychosocial data mining in order to amass predictive analytics that can be monetized to create new human capital bond markets for the new social impact finance economy of the fourth industrial revolution. Stated differently, the AI endgame is all about upgrading from surveillance capitalism to a techno-feudal panopticon in which workers and consumers are converted into literal human resources and indentured into algorithmic bondage to be bought and sold like digital chattel in the global social credit economy of the fourth industrial revolution. And that is my presentation.
I feel better.
I heard somebody say they were... I'd heard somebody say they were overwhelmed and scared during the last presentation. I was like, uh-oh, well, let's get ready for this next one, I think. So, questions? Yes, sir.
It sounds like this is very similar to RED, the R-E-D-D, where they're trying to sort of monetize nature itself. And so they're basically using human beings in the same way that they're doing it for cars in Brazil.
Yeah, and then those are largely, they're called natural asset companies. And so they're essentially the same idea. And I don't want to go too far into a detour here, but this is where you mentioned blockchain and crypto comes into this, because a lot of how they're going to program the payouts for these impact investments is going to be through the stable coins, through the crypto, because not only are they programmable, but you can sort of also extrapolate algorithms from the fintech financial technology inputs, the crypto inputs, and then in terms of education, the learning outcomes. And then from that, you get these predictive analytics that gets your social credit profiling, and this is going to determine for the students, like what jobs they get, et cetera. The idea of charter schools was coined by Albert Shanker. He's the president of the AFT for almost 30 years, okay? Randy Weingarten herself has ran a charter school before, right? And so I knew that that was coming one day. People, you know, who's the spokesperson, Corey DeAngelis is always, you know, anti-Weingarten, we've gone back and forth on social media. But Shanker was also a member of the Trilateral Commission, and so he's on record. You can go to my website and you can read my article. I did a series on a global union federation that it's called Education International, that the AFT and the NEA are a part of, and several of those people are members of the World Economic Forum. So that brings us full circle there. K-12 Inc. was funded by Ellison. K-12 Inc. was the first nationwide virtual charter school, online charter school, which basically set up the online platforms where you can plug in all these apps for data mining. And that was the chair of that, the person that set up K-12 Inc. was Bill Bennett, who was the Secretary of Education under Ronald Reagan, and it was Peter Thiel that wrote his speeches, okay? You mentioned the charter school thing. The next thing on the menu here is what they're calling school choice. Now, charter schooling is part of school choice, but this round of school choice is about the vouchers, or what are also known as education savings accounts. Sometimes they call them scholarships, tax-credited scholarships. It's all basically just vouchers with some small differences on how the monies are distributed. But I wrote my most recent article, it's at the top of my article page on my website, has to do with the PayPal Mafia's influence on this charter school, this voucher movement, largely them funding this digital wallet industry, which is going to be sort of the stepping stone or the intermediary through which you can eventually start transacting the stable coins for the programmable funds, as I noted. And so two of those digital wallet companies, one is Merit International, actually changed its name to Aspire Technologies not too long after I wrote the article. I'd like to think maybe that had something to do with the article, but who knows. Another one he funds is Odyssey, is called Odyssey. These are both funded by Andreessen Horowitz. Mark Andreessen is in the PayPal Mafia orbit, but he also was on the board of eBay again. So all these companies, all these public-private partnerships, these are all being propped up by the same oligarchs for the same agenda.
That was Professor John Kleizek, who has been studying the tech oligarchs and corporatized education in the U.S. and internationally. He spoke at a national conference on AI, labor, and the future of L.A. and the world in Wilmington, California, on February 7th. Was Kraftwerk, the robots. Next, public health epidemiologist Nicholas Hulscher of Focal Points and the McCullough Foundation discusses the implications of the arrest on February 2nd by local police in Las Vegas in connection with the discovery of a suspected biolab housed in a private home. Hulscher spoke to Brandon House of Worldview Tube on February 9th about this in the context of a recent global mapping study published in the Journal of Public Health on May 20th, 2025, which identified more than 3,600 biosafety level 3 and level 4 laboratories worldwide. The vast majority of these labs don't publicly disclose their locations or list the pathogens they study or what they do to them. The mapping study shows that roughly half of these facilities are located in the U.S., and that more than 300 lab leaks have occurred since 2001.
People virus thing, WHO issues alert as Nipah virus outbreak prompts quarantines throughout Asia. Are you following this? And again, I know it's been a big nothing burger up till now, but is it starting to be of concern, particularly if they're got any kind of gain of function going on?
Yeah, so regarding this situation, the India Nipah virus situation that's been all over the news for the past few weeks, that in particular is a nothing burger. There was only two confirmed cases. It was contained a few weeks ago, and we have not seen any other cases since. And so I'm not concerned about natural Nipah viruses adapting to humans and spreading. You know, that's very, very unlikely. What I'm concerned about is the biosafety level 3 and 4 laboratories across the globe that are working and creating synthetic Nipah viruses. And so a recent study came out that found there are over 3,500 biosafety level 3 and biosafety level 4 biolabs across the globe, and 73% of them don't disclose what pathogens they're working on or their exact locations. So we don't know where 73% of these labs are, where they could be doing anything under the sun. 91% of countries with a BSL-3 lab don't have any dual-use research oversight, so nobody's looking to see if they're doing anything nefarious. And about half of all of the global biolabs are in the United States. And so this is very, very worrisome. And now it's been revealed, apparently, that many of these labs are constructing Nipah viruses. They claim they're doing it for vaccines. They have patents on the Nipah virus proteins. They're already developing the mRNA injections for them. They are developing self-amplifying mRNA injections for them. And we have to remember, over 300 lab leaks have occurred since 2001. And so, you know, we got to watch out. We got to look and see what these undisclosed location labs are doing. And we got to put an end to all gain of function research. No more creating synthetic chimeric viruses. And we got to destroy all of these modified pathogens. We cannot have another man-made pandemic.
At this point, how do we know these haven't been sold off to some terrorist group, right? I mean, and then good luck finding those. It sounds to me that this isn't a matter of if, but when, that one of these labs is going to leak deliberately or accidentally, and we are going to have a problem. True or false?
It appears that it could be true, because this is the business model of the biopharmaceutical complex: to create the virus, release it, and then sell the countermeasure, which is even more dangerous. And so the same playbook can be repeated, because nobody's been held accountable. They're the same individuals in these labs. They're still walking around. They're still developing deadly and dangerous gene transfer mRNA injections. And yeah, they'll do it again. Bill Gates consistently, he keeps going on podcasts warning there will be another pandemic. And he says this bioterror attack. So they're going to admit it comes from a lab this time. And yeah, here, you know, we don't know what the main threat's going to be, but it's either from a basement bio lab like this, or the government-funded, government-ran, and nonprofit-ran bio labs. Mm-hmm. Both of them pose similar risks.
Knowing what you know, how are you preparing? How are you preparing your family?
I'm preparing my family most being as healthy and fit as possible, because if you are healthy and fit and not overweight and you don't have heart disease and high blood pressure, you will be able to fend off mostly any pathogen that comes at your way. So get as healthy as possible. You will be at utmost protected. But then also, it would be wise to have antiviral compounds on hand in case you do encounter any sort of biolab activities or any sort of biowarfare pathogens, such as basic things like vitamin C, zinc. So have that stuff on hand.
Before, a little bit from a Congressman Kevin Kelly, or Kylie, K-I-L-E-Y, from the 3rd District there in California. Listen to this.
That requires the immediate attention and immediate action from the United States Congress. An illegal bio lab was just raided in Las Vegas. And it is directly linked to the secret Chinese biolab found in Reedley, California in late 2022. The details of that report, but I'll start with its conclusion, that no one knows whether there are other unknown biolabs because there is no monitoring system in place. Well, now we know there was at least one other such lab, but we still don't know how many others, because the legislation, the bipartisan legislation that I have proposed with Representative Costa and Valadeo, has not yet been passed. So here's what we learned about this lab that was discovered in Reedley and that has now had a counterpart discovered in Las Vegas. It was run by an international fugitive from China named Jesse Zhu. After running various state-connected companies in China, Su moved to Canada, where he set up dozens of corporations to, quote, steal valuable American intellectual property and unlawfully transfer it to China. The Supreme Court of British Columbia found he committed, quote, fraud on an epic scale, resulting in a $330 million judgment. He then fled to America, assumed an alias, David He, and set up several more companies, including the one behind the Reedley Biolab and now the Vegas Biolab. He was indicted in 2023 and has been in federal custody ever since, but his partner and other associates have not been. Now, the Reedley lab was discovered in December of 2022 when a code inspector came upon a suspicious warehouse. Inside, she found many Chinese nationals wearing white lab coats, glasses, masks, and latex gloves, along with thousands of vials of biological substances and 1,000 mice. It was later learned these were transgenic mice genetically engineered to catch and carry the COVID-19 virus. A further inspection found blood, tissue, and other bodily fluid samples and serums, along with thousands of vials of, quote, suspected biological material. Some of the vials were labeled with the names of infectious agents, while others were labeled in a code that was never deciphered. Now, at first, the CDC, this was during the Biden administration, refused to investigate, and they even hung up on local officials who asked for help. After Representative Costa got involved, the CDC did an inspection and found at least 20 potentially infectious agents, including HIV, tuberculosis, and the deadliest known form of malaria. Yet, the CDC did not bother to test any samples, even those with unknown contents, making it, quote, impossible for the select committee to fully assess the potential risks that this specific facility posed to the community. The select committee report calls this baffling. Later, local officials discovered a refrigerator in the lab labeled Ebola. Now, while the supposed purpose of the lab was to sell test kits, in fact, all the company did was buy counterfeit kits from China and resell them in the United States.
We are so vulnerable, right? And if that one wasn't bad enough in Reedley, now we got Vegas. We got your report now over at the focalpoints.com. 73% don't disclose their locations or pathogen activities. 73%. And the bulk of these level four are in the U.S.
Half of the BSL-3s are in the U.S. The U.S. Yeah. And most of the BSL-4s. So, yeah, we are loaded with labs here from both, you know, these fraudster Chinese nationalists coming here to, you know, do who knows what. So obviously he was very dangerous. Thankfully, his laboratory complex was caught. But honestly, the risk he posed is nothing like the risk the over almost 2,000 American government-run biolabs pose, because they're literally creating viruses. Like, they're creating new pathogens to use for vaccines, and these can all leak out of their labs. They're not very contained very well. And we have to remember, most of these labs are in population centers. And so, yeah, there needs to be a serious crackdown on these bio laboratories. I don't want to have to say, yes, we're going to have another pandemic. And, you know, I think there's a future where we will not, if we do the right things and stop all of these illicit activities, both so-called legal by the government and by these seemingly bioterrorists. And so I think there's a way out and we can prevent it. Now, if we do nothing, hold nobody accountable, let them continue running their experiments and making money from experimental injections, then yeah, we will probably have another one by the same criminals. The meat I'm most concerned about now that's verifiably concerning is pork products. Because right currently, or actually for the past 10 years, nobody really knows this, but for the past 10 years, pigs, pigs breeded, bred for human consumption are injected with Merck's Sequivity RNA particle injections. This is a gene-based platform, and so it appears that pork may be contaminated with these RNA particles. We don't know which particular pork products. I would suspect ones that, you know, come not cooked. And so I would ensure if, you know, if you buy ham, if you buy even bacon, pork chops, sausages, hot dogs, just make sure they're cooked adequately. And then I would suspect that that should remove any residual RNA particles or at least degrade them. But it may be wise to reconsider eating pork given what they're being injected with.
Okay, let's see. Is there any other articles over at thefocalpoints.com that you want to highlight tonight?
Yes, there's a few others. Recently, the CDC, you see that CDC study there, this really went under the radar. And so what this study did in particular was the CDC looked at 8,000 pregnant women and they compared their outcomes to They compared 8,000 vaccinated pregnant women to 8,000 unvaccinated pregnant women. And so when comparing the vaccinated to the unvaccinated pregnant women, they found a 24% higher risk among vaccinated pregnant women of developing hypertensive disorders of pregnancy, which is the leading, one of the leading causes of fetal death and maternal death. And so the mom can die, they get a hypertensive crisis, the baby can die. And so basically what's happening is the mRNA shots that the CDC and other organizations told pregnant women to get increase the risk of a leading cause of fetal and maternal death. And so this should be front page news everywhere. It's coming from the CDC's own mouth, their own study, and I haven't seen anyone else reporting on it.
That was epidemiologist Nicholas Hulscher speaking to Brannon House at Worldview Tube about the implications of unregulated for-profit biolabs scattered around the U.S. and the world and calling for strict moratoriums on gain-of-function biologic research and the strict regulation and shutting down and destruction of all potential pandemic organisms, including Nipah, Corona, and avian virus strains, among others. And that concludes today's edition of Capitalism, Race, and Democracy. We thank all of Pacifica's sister stations and affiliates who contribute to the production of this show. Today's program was produced by the Capitalism, Race, and Democracy Collective with contributions from Thomas O'Rourke, Steve Seltzer, Polina Vasiliev, and myself, Ann Garrison. You can find this and all previous episodes at our website, capitalismraceanddemocracy.org. Make sure you click the subscribe button. Follow us on X, formerly Twitter, at PacificaCRD. I've been your host, Ann Garrison. Thanks for listening.